The second point that I think should be stressed, and this is where I have a great deal of sympathy for the comments of Dr. Haldos, is that it seems to me that the bottom line is that the maintenance of this lifestyle and culture which you people feel so strongly about has to, in the final analysis, come back to you people yourselves through land claim structures and other things. We can help provide rights, we can help provide guarantees, we can help provide structures which guarantee access to the political system. But it seems to me that people out practicing that lifestyle on an ongoing basis and teaching their children, as Jonathan was saying, seems to me to be the real backbone and spirit of the maintenance of that culture and lifestyle. I wish you good luck with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh. Willie Goodwin?
I'd like to go over a statement that I've been thinking about to impress upon the participants here that I think is very important to remember. Subsistence is dependent upon the availability of the resources that we harvest. Without the resources, then we can't subsist. NANA recognized that during the land selection process, and we made sure that we selected lands based on subsistence. And also one of the things that we thought about that played a key role in picking up these areas based on subsistence is we needed a negotiating level with the Park Service for D2 purposes and with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game for habitat management. The areas that we picked up are very key areas in the NANA region on the habitat. We know where the animals are, and we picked up land based on that knowledge. For that purpose, I think we should remember that 1991, just for land protection alone, is an Alaskan problem and not just a Native problem. Because those lands throughout the state that have been selected for subsistence are based on the availability of those resources around. And the Department of Fish and Game should remember that if we lose control of those lands, you know, we lose control of the habitat. I don't know how to bring it out any more bluntly, but the state should start worrying about 1991 too, just for that purpose alone, for protection of the habitat areas. It's not just a Native problem, it's an Alaskan problem. We could take some examples. We know for sure, or we get trends of talk. For instance, in Southeast, if there's no protection clauses of the land on there, we know that the timber companies are going to start buying up the land just to harvest the timber. And it could happen statewide for the key protection areas of the habitat or for habitat management are what the people selected under ANCSA. We all know that if we lose the land and we use for subsistence activity, the resources will be gone. The habitat plays a key role in this activity. And I would like to see, or if the state can give some effort in helping us either through legislation or any avenue for land protection. I don't know how we can go hand in hand in that, but I think we're going to have to end up doing that. Thank you.
Thank you for making that point regarding the links between ANCSA and subsistence. Dick Nelson?
I don't remember that I've ever been to a meeting where I kept my mouth shut for such a long period of time. There are two reasons for that. One is that the most important one is that most of what I would have said during these last 3 days was said by other people who said it better than I could have and who understood things much more deeply than I do. And the other reason is that I feel that it's very important with the emergence of very capable Native leadership that those of us who know less should butt out anyway. But I'd just like to make a couple of observations based on what little bit I do know from having been involved with subsistence at both the village level and the sitting around the table level for the past 20 years. One of the most important things that was brought out here in earlier testimony was the fact that subsistence is a way of life and not just an economy. Every one of us who's been involved with subsistence over the years up here has heard that statement time and time and time again. And every one of us who has been involved with subsistence up here over the years has seen it ignored time and time and time again. Agencies seem to find it very difficult to deal with subsistence as something other than an economic system, as something other than tables full of numbers or lines drawn on maps. And as the people here who are involved in subsistence, like Willie and like Mr. Rexford and like Jonathan Solomon and Austin Hammond, have showed us very clearly that the time is long past when Westerners have to begin to recognize subsistence as something much more than an economic system. Well, there's no use to howl at the wind over that, but I think the most striking example of that I've seen in a long time was Mr. Austin Hammond's description of the meaning of his Chilkat blanket, which almost none of us here could understand because he was speaking in his Tlingit language. But we could see very clearly, I think, that Tlingit culture is interwoven with its environment just as tightly as the threads on that Chilkat blanket that he was showing to us. And I think that what Willie's comments just brought out, and what many other people's comments have brought out, is that if you start to pull the threads out of the Chilkat blanket, you end up with just a jumble of threads and nothing else, nothing integrated, nothing whole, and nothing useful. And so one of the key issues, and I'm really trying to get at something other than a philosophical point here, is that people have to keep those threads together. Now, what really seems important here out of this meeting is that the Native people themselves are developing mechanisms that will hold the threads together and that will prevent the shredding apart by outside influences and by all the things that are going on nowadays. These institutions like the Eskimo Walrus Commission and the Whaling Commission and the Porcupine, I don't remember the names of them, you know, and all this stuff you guys are doing in Canada. These are really powerful illustrations of the determination of Native people to hold the threads of their lives together and to keep that their life unified and whole and beautiful. I remember very clearly Jonathan Solomon's discussion of his people's way of life as a part of the ecosystem, that in fact, as I understand what you said, your people are a part of that ecosystem, and the fact that you understand that ecosystem better than any outsider could. Of course, with many thousands of years of experience and study to draw on, that is a clear and ringing truth. Now, the development of local mechanisms to control the use and management of subsistence resources brings with it also the responsibility to maintain the health of those resources, as to use Mr. Monahan's words. And nowadays, with these new commissions and mechanisms that Native people are developing, they're giving themselves the power to exert their traditional responsibility. As most of you know, I think, in native cultures, there have been intricate and elaborately woven mechanisms to ensure that responsibility. Woodrow Morrison spoke the first day about the traditional beliefs of the Haida people and the way in which those beliefs brought people into a community, a living community with their environment. And of course, you know that system of belief has at least traditionally existed among all Native Alaskans and probably among all Native Americans as well. Now, in the past, with the Native Alaskan people, conflicts over the management of subsistence resources have mainly arisen because of outside interests impinging on Native lands or on Native resources. 90% at least of the discussion here has been devoted to issues of how to control the access to and allocation of subsistence resources. And I think rightly so, in that allocation is the most immediate problem with subsistence resources. But I would like to suggest, from what little bit of experience I have, that it's not the most important problem in the long run. The most important problem is what Willie Goodman just brought up. Willie Goodwin just brought up. And that is the maintenance of that habitat. I think it's clear from the experience of people in the north, and if it isn't, then all you have to do is travel south to discover that you cannot have development on unaltered natural landscapes without somehow altering the natural community. And because subsistence is a part of that natural community, you will then alter subsistence as well. You can't have it both ways. Or somebody just had a little analogy over here too. You can't have your cake and eat it too, basically. So here's one thing that I'm very, very concerned with. Number one, I know that Native people are watching very closely the interests of outside people in lands adjacent to or in their own lands. The Eskimo Whaling Commission is an excellent example of that. But we have to remember as well that nowadays the Native people are all shareholders in corporate enterprises themselves. And I think that it's going to be very important that the Native people monitor and study the activities of their own corporate enterprises with a very clear concept of the importance of subsistence in their own minds. It doesn't matter who cuts down the forest. Once the forest is gone, the effect is the same. Whether the hand on the chainsaw is a Native hand or a white man's hand, is, in my opinion, doesn't make any difference in terms of the effect on subsistence. I am not saying anything at all about the long-range benefits or non-benefits of corporate activities. I'm only talking about subsistence here. What I guess I have in mind, and this is following from the comments of Joe Meeker and Gary Holthaus and Jonathan Solomon and others here, is that if I were a Native person living in a village right now, one of the most important things on my mind in the long term would be the incorporation of traditional Native values into the functioning of corporate enterprises that are under Native control. As a resident of the planet Earth, I would like to see bringing of traditional Native values into the operations of corporate enterprises, period, not just Native corporation enterprises. What I'm thinking about here is that the Native people in Alaska are in a position, number one, to show the world at large a better way of relating to their environment. I'm thinking along the lines of the comments of Joe and also of some of the wisdom in Jonathan Solomon's testimony. The world at large is in a position to learn something about a way of relating to the environment because Native people have lived in this country for at least 15,000 years and in all likelihood 30,000 years, possibly more. And this country has remained as pristine and productive as it was when they first arrived. In no case, I think, will you see that Western cultures have related to their environment in such a fruitful and productive way over the long term. Now, the point, but I didn't dare just jump into this without prefacing it, and the point only takes a few seconds. The Alaska Native Land Claims Act set up a system by which all Native Alaskans become a part of what is sort of the ultimate manifestation of Western culture, and that is the corporation. Now, we are just at the very beginning of seeing what corporations, Native corporations, can or cannot do here. And so I don't think we can make a judgment right now as to whether this is going to go well or it's going to go badly. But I think we have a few examples, and I'm thinking of Southeast Alaska, where I live, in which I think that the subsistence interests have not been served by native corporate activities because of wholesale alteration of the environment, logging, because timber harvesting is detrimental to one of the most important subsistence resources, and that is deer. And I think I would say that there ought to be a little red light flashing there, and people should be looking and deciding where subsistence falls in their list of priorities. I've heard it said by Native elders that our land is just like money in the bank, as an analogy. And I think that there's going to be in the future every impetus to go for the white man's money in the bank and to draw out everything that's in that other account, and that is the land. Now, finally, I think that some Native corporations in the state have drawn very strongly on their own traditions in making corporate decisions. I was very impressed by Jonathan's discussion of his own community's resistance to oil exploration on their lands because they felt that their land selections, as Willie pointed out, had been done for purposes of subsistence, not commercial development. I hope that those kinds of traditional concerns will continue to dominate the discussion of the direction of corporate decisions in Native areas of Alaska. Because I would like to see Native corporations setting a higher example than the example that has been set by Western corporations. Of all the people in the world who are in a position right now to demonstrate a direction for corporate enterprise to move in, no one is in a better position than the Alaska Natives, because Westerners simply do not have the wisdom of 15 to 30,000 years of living on the land to guide them, and Native people do. So I would say that Alaska and the North are the perfect places to see a very important new direction set in the effort to bring together traditional interests in the land with possibly non-traditional interests in the land, and to set a standard quite different from and much higher than that has been set by Western cultures. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. Thank you, Dick. Dolly Garza.
I don't represent any particular Native group, and so what I have to say is my personal opinions. And that is, first, in speaking with the Natives in the last few days, those some who are on this round table and some who have come and gone, that there's a general disappointment with the success of this round table. We did not come here to hear various definitions of subsistence. We know what it is in our hearts. And with that, I'd like to say I thought we came here to discuss how ANCSA has affected subsistence. And I would like to bring out four major issues. Maybe we are all aware of these four issues, but I think that they need to be brought out. And the first is that which Dick Nelson just talked about. And that is with the native corporations. There has been a distribution of authority. There has been a division of the people because of corporations. Large corporations who have investment interests and resources can hardly back environmental issues which villagers are bringing up. And I think we've seen that in the majority of the regional corporations. How can a regional corporation who is invested in oil support major environmental issues? While native corporations have supported it, I think, to some extent, it has not been to the extent to create the necessary legislative changes to protect the subsistence needs. The second thing I'd like to bring up in the redistribution of authority is that I think there has been a redistribution of authority to AFN. One of the things that was discussed yesterday with the Eskimo Walrus Commission is that AFN did not properly represent the Inupiaq, the Yupik, or the Siberian Yupik in addressing the amendments to the 1981 Marine Mammal Protection Act. And because of how AFN influenced those amendments, there could potentially be major negative effects on the subsistence users. The third thing I'd like to mention is how easily legislation can have far-reaching negative impacts, and how we as natives have been unaware of how far-reaching these native impacts can be. And as we start working on various native commissions and attempting to be more influential when we address resource issues, we need to be wary of these potential impacts. Fourth, in terms of how I think ANCSA has had negative impacts on subsistence uses, is that there is a general negative public reaction because of the wealth that we received, not addressing the issue of whether or not it was ours to begin with. But there are many non-natives who feel that we have been given so much that we are being greedy and asking to maintain our subsistence rights. As far as solutions, I think that we as natives have to approach AFN and make sure that they are representing us, and that is our fault. In terms of regional corporations, I don't know how to face them, nor do I know how to face the negative public publicity. But in conclusion, we need to learn how to face legislation. And in addition, I think we need to make natives be aware of how important the commissions such as the Eskimo Walrus Commission and the Eskimo Whaling Commission, how important they are, so that natives in the different areas can begin addressing subsistence issues in their own commissions. Thank you.
Thank you. Marie?
Well, I guess we're coming to a close. I'd like to give my own impressions and share my own impressions with all of you. I've learned a lot about different viewpoints of people who come from different lands, and also see how we're perceived from different areas of the world. I would like to addressing ANCSA. If you look at the North Slope, the native lands don't cover very much of the area that we use for resources. We have the the petroleum reserve, the wildlife refuge, the gates of the Arctic Park. Also, to in addressing how do we justify ourselves now, and how are we going to do it? It's too bad that we've gotten to that point, that we now have to justify ourselves legally, assert our rights. We've tried, you know, people didn't come up and see what was going on when they were creating the laws. They didn't talk to us to see what was there. So what was made was very inadequate. It hurt the people instead of helped them, and that's been evident. And I would like to say this in our experience with the Whaling Commission. The Yankee whalers came up and depleted the resource, and then we were faced with a ban in 1977 because of competition between consumptive uses and non-consumptive uses. I'd like to make it, I mean, that's putting it very simply. You know, there are people who would rather not see us go out and hunt and live our lifestyle. That's a continuing battle, and I expect it would be a continuing battle for all of us because of the way the world is going. But hopefully in the future there'll be more understanding. Then with, you know, it almost feels like we've piecemealed your land, and then we've restricted your use, you know, and try and still maintain your culture. I mean, it's like the governments in their way of dealing with the native people have, you know, piecemealed our land inadequately, and they didn't address the needs that we have. And then, you know, cutting that off, then they cut a little bit more here and there, and then tell us, maintain your culture. How can we maintain your, you know, try and maintain your culture? We're faced with a monumental problem of trying to explain, we have our culture. I mean, it's being maintained. I don't see why we have, I mean, I don't see, should we have to go and justify ourselves in front of the law, the governments, and people who are looking at our activities because they're interested in saving the whales or making sure that the resources are not being hurt. I think people have to open their minds and start viewing it as the natives view it. It's a whole life that you're dealing with up there where I'm from. We tie ourselves to the land, we tie ourselves to our resources, we tie ourselves to, our spiritual life is connected to all of those things. We don't have institutions to, I mean, we originally did not have any institutions which are now present today in our lives, you know. So even with the changes that have come up, we have something that's still alive today. It's, you can't put it, you know, we can't show it, because if you just look at the way things are up north, look at the people, what they look like, what they're dressed like, what they're eating, you can't see it. It's something that is in here, in our spirits, in our hearts. And it's, like I said, it's too bad that people aren't accepting sometimes. We've accepted our fellow human beings. We accept them when they come in. We treat them with respect. And that's what we strive for when we're trying to assert our rights. Is not do it disrespectfully, but hope that people would understand and learn to accept us for who we are. not who they want us to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie. Weaver, and then Jim.
I feel very strongly, like Marie does, that subsistence is more than just the taking of animals. There is that spiritual relationship. Just to give an instance, when my father and myself go out hunting and he catches a nugruk, it's always a kliana. I've got meat on the table. Thank you. I've got something to feed my family with. And it's with that feeling and that flavor of harvesting that resources, I think that makes a hell of a lot of difference than how we feel right now about the animals and the land. And as I said earlier, if we're relying on other agencies to regulate or manage our way of life, the subsistence resource, then I think we're looking at probably losing that resource. We probably won't lose that way, our way of life, but we'll lose something there that's very critical to us, and that's survival. Subsistence is way of life, but it's also a survival of our people. And it's been that way for thousands and thousands of years. That's why we perpetuated the environment. That's why we made sure that the animals come back. Some years back, the subsistence law in the state of Alaska passed the priority subsistence law, and it's been a great help. But when Jim talked about earlier, Jim Kowalski talked earlier about the military growth that's pending in Alaska, 6,000 military people coming in through the government, you know, that will directly affect the people. Subsistence law will get thrown out. I'm pretty goddamn sure about that, you know. So you can't rely. You've got to, like Chief Solomon and Burton Reckford said, you cannot depend on the other agencies to do that. You're going to have to regulate it and manage it on your own. And I like what Burton Reckford says. You have to, if you want to regulate yourself, you have to do it on your regional level, doing it by region. When that subsistence law passed, the subsistence priority law passed, I immediately thought of a lot of my people out there camping. And then I thought about a lot of people here in Anchorage and Fairbanks in the urban areas. The man out there who's alone in his cabin gathering food is living off no other law but to live off the land. The law, the subsistence law, for all he cares, is something on a piece of paper that's protecting somebody else. There's no real impact on the urban area, or it's minimum. I shouldn't say there's no real impact. The real impact is out there on that guy who's trying to make a living off the land. And he's got the right to do that. But at the same time, we still have to work together. We still have to have that cooperation to make this thing work, with the state, the IRAs, and the federal government, you know, because there is a lot going on out there. But the protection, again, of our people, like I said, the elders, is the crucial part. Earlier, Peter asked about the enforcement of, once you get all this regime going, you got your local control. How are you going to enforce it? It was simple in the past because we've had the respect and honesty of the Native people. if an elder wouldn't have to even tell you that you're doing wrong. The way we did it was just a hint. Maybe someone is taking too much fish. And that's what he would say to you. He wouldn't say, you're taking too much fish, you got to cut it out, we'll throw you in jail. You know, he'd say, maybe somebody's taking too much fish. And so that would stop and take only what you need. But now it's gotten more complex. And there's other things that are going on. But there is still that ability to govern and enforce ourselves with an elder's council or the elder's advice and leadership incorporated into the IRA or the Native Village structure of regulating subsistence, because they've done that for years and years. And their advice is followed very closely now as it was in the past.
Thank you, Weaver. Jim and then Jonathan.
Okay, I'd just like to make a
Jim Kowalski for
summary.
Go ahead.
Make a few summary remarks. I have a strategy. Maybe with all these additional military, the strategy might be that since we have a federal law that says there's a priority, maybe we should have the military help us defend it, since they're coming here in such great numbers. Well, I'm joking a little bit, but I was thinking that I didn't really answer Joe's Meeker's question yesterday about what would the strategy be, and Joe, I don't have any better answer than that one. I want to respond in summary to Dan Gross. He expressed amazement this morning. Where did he go? At all of the commissions and so forth that subsistence people are expected to serve on, and doesn't that detract from the activity? And I suppose the answer is obvious, but I wanted to just tell him, from my experience working only as a technician for a large regional Native organization, the answer surely is yes. And my point here is that I hope that the tremendous burden that is that rests with the subsistence community, as we might call it, to defend their interests through all of these commissions and boards and what have you, may be grossly misunderstood and underrated in both government, who oftentimes are very proud of the fact that now we have all of these laws and we have these federal standards for public participation, for advisory committees, for regional councils, that I just hope they don't misunderstand what a terrific task it is for especially the far-flung rural peoples to come together and participate in this system. It's just awesome, and the folks in the small communities get burned out mighty fast in some cases. Very, very good leadership that just can't keep coming to these meetings and giving up weeks at a time on the trap line, or coming right from fish camps to attend a regional council meeting. So I don't want to see that burden underestimated by both our servants in state government, in federal government, and also the Alaskan public generally. In other words, the burden of making the subsistence priority, for example, work, is really, I think, rather substantial. And let's please not underestimate the effort and the anguish and the high levels of frustration among the people whose task it is to make this work, that is, the users themselves. Let's not underestimate that. I'm very concerned about that. And it's easy for people like myself, who are hired to do these things, to travel to these meetings, but if I have to ask an individual who may be from a community to come and represent his interests, or for that matter, even to go out there where he is, taking his time away from that productivity or these other activities, or maybe he has to cancel a meeting with the school board because he or she may be in a small community, may be called on to serve on all kinds of committees and boards. What I'm saying is, even I think I underestimate at times the difficulty that people have trying to work in these systems. It is not easy. In fact, it's very difficult, I think, for many people. Okay, and my other point would be, in summary, would be that I'm so pleased to see biologists here from Canada. I wonder where they are from Alaska. I may have missed some people coming in here, but I kind of know who they are, and I don't see them, and I'm disappointed at that. I'm going to suggest that the difficulty that we have in bringing together traditional knowledge and cooperation with the graduate school biologists from Louisiana State or from the University of Alaska, for that matter, who work in direct contact in the management of game and fish resources with rural native people, that really concerns me. There is, I think there's still, and this is perhaps a great generalization, but I think in the region that I work in, there is still a substantial insensitivity by rural-based biologists, and this is a rather strong comment, I realize, but I hear it all of the time, that many of the people who are biologists who are working directly in contact, either they live in rural communities or they spend a lot of time there, or they avoid spending time there at all costs, that there is an insensitivity, there's a lack of willingness. There are also many bitter memories of a very bitter subsistence repeal debate in which many professional biologists working for the state of Alaska aligned themselves with the other side publicly in the most unethical, unprofessional behavior imaginable, and the memory of that has not gone away. That is, now the rural native users who have to confront these people, that they are embarrassed at times to do so. There's a tremendous distrust there, and Hugh Monahan at our little meeting of the Porcupine Caribou Commission the other night said it so well, that there is a great difference between efficiency and effectiveness, and that is something that Canadian biologists have had to learn, and that to me is a wonderful phrase, because our biologists are certainly efficient, but I question their effectiveness. And I think there is an insensitivity that is almost institutional. I would say that this administration and this commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game and his deputy commissioners have worked very hard to overcome that. But it is a substantial impediment to effectiveness for management of resources because of the distrust and the insensitivity that many of these people still openly harbor as they go about their work. I wonder if it wouldn't be possible to consider making as a requirement of any of the biologists, federal or state, who work directly in contact with rural native people to have some kind of cross-cultural training. As I understand, either the teachers of the state are being required to do that or are about to be. I'm not sure about that. I say, why not make the biologists do the same thing? So let me leave with that note then.
Right. Thank you, Jim. Jonathan Solomon.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank all the people that came here, especially my native brothers and sister that talked here, and I learned a lot of things from it. On the other hand, the first day of this meeting when I criticized some other people that were not native people, and I want to apologize to that because I knew that something had to be done to set the tone of this meeting. And especially with Tom and Jerry Holhauser and Don Mitchell. I know that they weren't talking here to these people that are gathering here because we all support subsistence. But we have to let the other 500,000 people of the state of Alaska know or try to understand what our rural people are trying to say. On the other hand, when we talk about subsistence in the areas, we should be talking about native culture in their land. I never heard the word subsistence until 1971 under the Native Land Claims Act. Before that time, when I was brought up in the culture of my people, it's always been our culture and our land. You cannot break out subsistence or the meaning of subsistence or try to identify it, and you can't break it out of the culture. The culture and the life of my native people are the subsistence act way of life. And that's what we always use, the subsistence way of life. It goes hand in hand with our own culture, our own language, and all our activities. When Native people have potlatches, and they have giveaway potlatches, they give you a blanket. That's all subsistent to us, even though that blanket came from Sears Roebuck. And people just don't understand what the rural Native people are trying to say because of this. To a non-rural resident that just come out of the plane from Seattle, you know, subsistent to him means animal, resources on the land. It doesn't mean that to me. I just want some people to understand that. On the other hand, we talk about sovereignty of these people. I grew up as an RAA Council sovereignty nation. I grew up in the village of Fort Yukon. And I told you guys that I am the chief of the 3G. But I'm also the second chief of the RAA Native Council of Fort Yukon Village. I'm also the mayor of the city of Fort Yukon. I had an opportunity last year to write to myself as the mayor and council of Fort Yukon City, Inc. by the request of my first chief, Clarence Alexander, concerning lands in the city of Fort Yukon. Because I was the second chief, he ordered me to write to my own self. And I did. In that letter I said, When the Native village of Fort Yukon in 1949 was destroyed in a flood, we move up on the hill, and at that time we request BIA that land become the part of the reservation of the Lower Village. And BIA had hearings and there was no objection.